Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Lifetime Cinema Club. We are the podcast that is counting down what we consider to be the top 10 films of each year, beginning in 1980 and going all the way to current day. And as always, I am your host, Ryan, and I'm joined once again by the brains behind the entire operation, Holsh. How you doing, buddy?
Mate, I'm doing really well, Chip. More importantly, how are you and the family doing?
I haven't been going too good, if I'm being completely honest, the last few weeks. I have received a couple of messages and emails from devoted fans. They had noticed a missed week in the last fortnight where we didn't upload an episode. And, of course, we sincerely apologize for letting you guys down. Holsh, I know you've had a particularly busy fortnight with your business.
Yeah, but nothing like what you've gone through.
Yeah, and as for us in Ryan's household, we have had 2 weeks of continued viruses and of the nasty kind. We're talking stomach bugs. Got two young children and they brought home a vomiting bug twice, actually, which was great. So we have been hit with these viruses and we've been very ill. And look, it has left me incapable of the endurance that's needed for podcasting, right? So it's pretty topical that the Olympics are on at the moment. And look, the fitness needed to do a pod like this, it's high level, right? It's Olympic-esque. You know, we put our heart and soul into this. These guys going to the Olympics, they only do it every 4 years. We're doing it every week.
Yeah, I've stayed on the training bike, just kept warm for the last two weeks till you were available again. So I'm glad you're over the injury.
At our advanced age, Holsh, we don't, you know, you can pull a calf muscle by sneezing. You can tear an Achilles by getting out of bed. You know, so we need to stay limber, warm, do our stretches, do our breath work. Anyway, now, tonight we are up to episode 5, which lands us on the film coming in at number 6 for 1980. To recap on our previous films that we've ranked for 1980, Inferno, directed by Dario Argento, came in at number 10. The Long Good Friday, the Cockney gangster classic, starring Bob Hoskins and Helen Mirren, was in at number 9. Nicholas Roeg's sexual obsession drama, Bad Timing, came in at number 8. And the previous episode, we featured William Friedkin going freak mode with a leather daddy goat in Al Pacino in Cruising, which was our number 7 for 1980. Now, on to our number 6. We're up to number 6 for 1980 tonight. And speaking of goats, Holsh, you know I love to collect goats. I'm a bit of a goat farmer. This film is the first time a trio of goats worked together. I speak, of course, if you haven't guessed already, or seen the graphic on that gives away what the episode's about anyway on Spotify. I speak, of course, of Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro, and that little feisty guy, our little feisty buddy, Joe Pesci. And the film that we are going to discuss tonight is Raging Bull.
Welcome to Lifetime Cinema Club.
Alrighty, so as we always do in the lead up to talking about these films, I will jump on ye old Letterboxd and give the Letterboxd plot synopsis. And it is as follows. When Jake LaMotta steps into a boxing ring and obliterates his opponent, he's a prize fighter. But when he treats his family and friends the same way, he's a ticking time bomb, ready to go off at any moment. Though LaMotta wants his family's love, something always seems to come between them. Perhaps it's his violent bouts of paranoia and jealousy. This kind of rage helped make him a champ, but in real life, he winds up in the ring alone, which is a very apt breakdown of the film. We have Robert De Niro playing the Raging Bull, the Bronx Bull, Jake LaMotta, and what is probably fair to say is a career best performance, which, fuck me, is saying a lot considering you're talking about the resume that De Niro has. His co-star in this, obviously, is Joe Pesci, who's playing Joey, Jake's brother, and also his sports agent slash manager. Also, Kathy Moriarty stars as Jake's second wife and the object of his initial affection, and then the object of his jealous obsession. Kathy Moriarty plays Vicky LaMotta, Jake's second wife. From the very beginning of the film, we see that Jake LaMotta is a man who is all violence and very little substance. Well, maybe the substance is violence with Jake. We are thrown straight into a fight at the beginning of the film that Jake loses only through the fact that his opponent is saved by the bell. After this fight, when he is home with his first wife, he cannot control his rage after this fight. Basically nitpicks and starts a fight with her about cooking dinner, and this devolves into a physical confrontation. His brother Joey, obviously again played by Joe Pesci, arrives and de-escalates the conflict, but instead of calming Jake down, Jake just basically demands or threatens Joey to punch him in the face as hard as he can. So right from the tip of this film, right from the beginning, you see the type of person that we're dealing with, and violence is the only thing that he understands. It's the only way he can communicate. It's his language is violence. Holsch, this is a film that is renowned as being one of the greatest of all time. Was this a first time watch for you during this project?
It was. And I have to say that this particular film hit me in a whole different way to the first four films that you've introduced me to in this top 10 in 1980. I can see the masterpiece it is from the skill set of Martin Scorsese and is it Thelma?
Schoonmaker?
Yeah. Look, the film itself is stunning. And I watched it on the Criterion 4K release, which is just, I think it's probably one of the top five most stunning films I've seen on my little cinema at home here. At the same time, when I finished watching this film, I was like, I didn't know how to take it, where to go after watching this portrayal of this character, Jake LaMotta. It was, I guess with the first four movies that you gave me, I'd finish the film and the first thing I'd do was jump online because I'd have like 15, 20 questions in my head that I needed answered. I needed to like dive deeper. Whereas this one, whilst masterfully done, is really quite a straightforward tale or bio. I did watch it twice and yeah, look, it is an incredible film.
It is. And like you said, mate, Martin Scorsese had already shown his chops with Taxi Driver, which came out a few years before this. And obviously that was what launched De Niro, as well as Godfather 2 with Francis Ford, into the absolute stratosphere as far as being the leaders in their field, both in being an auteur or a film director or being an actor in De Niro's case. And it is a film since rewatching it, and even though I've got it ranked sixth, out of the other four films that we've watched, like you said, it's probably the film that hasn't risen in my estimation. I feel ashamed to rank it any less than this in its yearly ranking. It would be disrespectful of me to have it any less than this because I understand and can see the master craftsman at work here in all the facets, the crew, the cinematographer, the editing, everything in this is just incredible. And I have to say, I'm quite jealous that you've seen the Criterion 4K because I'm slumming it on an Amazon Prime stream, by the way. So one of these days I want to fucking borrow that disc you've got. It is an incredible film to watch, to experience. But I'm like you, I don't know whether it's my dislike of most biopics that holds me back from loving this film like I know I should. And I say that again, this is still an absolute classic. And I understand every time I see it listed in a Sight and Sound ballot from somebody, or I see it on a list on Letterboxd where people said that the greatest films of all time, this is so highly thought of. I get it and I completely understand it. It's just not my personal all-time favorite. It wouldn't crack my top 100, for example. But in saying that, again, the skill on display here by everyone involved is so obvious and it is so, so well crafted. And it's funny, you know, it's almost you got a subject like Jake LaMotta, who is just an absolute beast and has no finesse to him at all, and yet this film has so much finesse to it. The film excels at not sympathizing with Jake LaMotta, and it also doesn't really attack him too much until we get to the towards the end of the film. But it rather just pities him. It shows him as being just this pitiful character where violence and paranoia just consumes him throughout the film. It's a credit to De Niro's performance, and again, I'll talk about this a little bit later on tonight, but he plays a character or a person in LaMotta that is so full of self-confidence but so riddled with self-loathing at the same time that the performance is just incredible. If I had one criticism of the film at all, I would have liked, and I know the film is based on the writing of Jake LaMotta, which I don't know. I haven't seen an original autobiography or what Jake actually wrote himself. This was obviously written for the screen by Paul Schrader, who was an absolute legend and worked with Scorsese a lot in the early years, obviously helped write Taxi Driver as well. It's this technical perfection in filmmaking. It's about someone who is so not technically proficient. Even as a fighter, LaMotta was a brawler. And the film just doesn't ever really glorify him, which is so well done. And this is a theme that goes through Martin Scorsese's career, basically. Quite often through Scorsese's resume and career and portfolio, he's been criticized for seemingly glorifying violence and excess through his career. It's a criticism that I've always found really unwarranted. And I think the confusion comes about because of Marty's eye for shot making and for his skill at creating images, where everything he films looks stylish because of his skill. But often the violence and ugliness is still present and obvious if you can look past the sheen of his technique. I find this particularly interesting in Martin Scorsese's later work, and this is like a prototype of the later work. Films like The Wolf of Wall Street, The Irishman, and most recently like The Killers of the Flower Moon, all show men who have lived to either excess through selfishness and violence, and by the end of their life and by the end of the film, it all amounts to nothing. They are left empty and full of remorse. I've always found it really fascinating that a lot of, I don't want to say film bros, because I'm fucking probably one of these people, right, who have gone through and have watched things like Goodfellas and thought, man, Henry Hill's so fucking cool, man. What a cool gangster he was. But that's not what the story is, and that's just like Raging Bull. You could go through and watch this tough, incredibly hardened boxer who fought the odds and went from nothing to world champion, albeit pretty briefly, but he's an absolute bum. He abuses every woman that's been in his life. He abuses his own family. And my one criticism, one wish that this film could have maybe touched on, I don't know how you do it. I just wish there could have been a little bit of insight into the early family history of Jake LaMotta, because what I'm guessing is there was a cycle of violence in his youth, and a cycle of violence needs a circuit breaker, and obviously Jake LaMotta is not the man to break that fucking cycle.
Apparently early, when he was 8 years old, he got beat up at school, and he came home and his dad, who's a bit of a hard nut himself, said to him, look, just don't let that ever happen again. Next time you fight back and apparently from that incident onwards, he lived his life like he didn't care what would happen. And that gave a little bit of an insight of, you know, what we saw in this movie and the way that he treats everybody in his life, I guess.
Yeah, he just says everything through his fists. I didn't realize that story about being beat up at 8. I just probably assumed he may have lived through some sort of domestic violence himself. But, you know, this film is set in the 40s, obviously it's a true story to a certain extent. There has been some allegations from Jake LaMotta that obviously it has been, you know, inverted commas, Hollywoodized slightly with certain details. But, you know, these are hard times that created really hard and violent people coming out of back-to-back world wars, people living, you know, really hard, really rough times. I guess I assume, because the film just drops you straight into Jake's boxing career right from the tip. So there's really not a lot of reflection through the film. So you kind of assume that this is learned behavior. This getting his way through beating the shit out of people is a learned behavior. Was there anything that you did in your research? Because you're the research guy. I'm the vibes guy. I'm the dude that's kicking back and just, you know,
yeah, chilling. Well, Martin Scorsese, at this point in time in his life, was about to kill himself. Huge cocaine addiction. And
massive. And he notoriously, the dude was just a fiend for the fucking marching powder.
That's right. And, you know, he was suffering from depression and all this sort of shit. He was done with movies, with directing. And years before all this, De Niro had come forward to him with the La Motta book and said, you know, I think this is a character we should put a movie on. And he said, look, I don't like sports. I especially don't like boxing. I'm just not interested. And it took years and years. And there's a whole story behind all of it. But eventually he essentially said to Scorsese, look, you can keep wasting away your life, you know, finish, do nothing, you know, and be happy, or you can do this and we're going to create something really special here. And eventually Scorsese came on board, and they actually had two writers. There was I forget the other writer, but he had worked with Scorsese on one of his last films up to this date, and then Paul Schrader came in and rewrote it. Scorsese said, this is going to portray this La Motta bloke, and I don't care what the critics think, what anyone thinks, this is his story as it is. Even though you're right, there is some moments through it that have been tweaked for the movie itself. But, you know, the movie is a paradox. Every single shot is so elegant and so much detail, and, you know, it's like visual poetry, this movie from start to end. Yet it's about this bloke that's got this ugly viciousness to him. And we talk about Alex and Bad Timing, but, you know, this guy has that same paranoia that leads to, you know, the wrong end for a lot of people. So you've got this almost like ballet-like classical music that starts the film, and he's standing there inside the ring. The ring is essentially that one area that justifies his wild behavior. La Motta is okay to have this violence in him because of the ring. And while he's in there, from the start, he's by himself in that ring. The end of the movie, he's by himself. It's such a beautiful shot. So even in the 4K, it's got that beautiful grain, film grain. And you can see the front row of spectators or judges and so forth. But in the background, you see this little flash go off every about 5 seconds. It's all in slow motion, and slow motion is a huge part of this movie in the way that Marty shoots it. The lead of cinematography, he was dressed in black, and he would go in the back of the crowd and set off manually these flashes. And it sort of shows right from the outset of this film the amount of detail that Scorsese was going to just put into this. Yeah, look, I think you could talk about nearly every scene in such high regard because he doesn't let up for the whole movie.
Yeah, it is absolutely flawless technical filmmaking. And you said it really well there too, Holsch, where it's a poetic film about someone and something so ugly. The sport of boxing is such a violent sport, and I'm a pacifist. I'm not a big contact sport fan anymore. It's to play football as a young fella. I'm not overly invested in it anymore. I've probably been in three fights in my entire life and lost all three. convincing loser in all three. And, you know, it's funny, Scorsese and the lead cinematographer, a guy called Michael Chapman, the way they shoot the fighting scenes. Actually, on that, Michael Chapman has an interesting career. He worked with Marty on Taxi Driver, you know, legendary. And again, spoiler alert, a bit of a normie pick, but probably still my favorite Scorsese film. He also worked with Paul Schrader, an early film of Paul Schrader's called Hardcore. Interesting tidbit. Holsch, and you'd like to know this, as I know you're a massive fan, Michael Chapman, was lead cinematographer on Space Jam, of all films. So there you go.
Hopefully the Michael Jordan version, not the LeBron.
Sorry. Yes, that was an absolute one of the worst films I've ever had to sit through at a cinema because my kids wanted to go see it. Was Space Jam 2.
I did it too. Oh, never again.
What a piece of shit that was. Anyway, the interesting thing, and you just made me think about this, is as beautifully shot as these fight scenes are, you can still tell that Martin Scorsese hates boxing. Because of especially that final real bloodbath fight between LaMotta and Sugar Ray Robinson, who, you know, what a incredible rivalry those guys had. I think they fought four or five times. Is that correct?
Six times.
Incredible. And look,
LaMotta won one.
He won one.
Yep.
And like he says at the end of the film, like, you never knocked me down. You beat me, but you never put me down. The thing with the shots, especially of the fighting within the ring and of the fight scenes, is the camera just glides through the ring. We get a combination of multiple different shots. You get these POV shots. You get overhead crane and some dolly shots through there, some static and still shots from a variety of angles. There's some really creative angles, like the way they have the camera held at almost like this obtuse kind of angle when someone's in these other fights where Jake wins, where he's knocked out an opponent and they've fallen to the canvas. It's a really interesting way of shooting the fights. And the black and white photography gives it a sense of, obviously, time. It's set in the 40s era filmmaking all over again. But it also adds a real depth to the images, I think, the black and white cinematography. I don't think we would get the same depth from a color, from using color, right? The steam from the bodies is just incredible. I just love all of those scenes in the ring where they focus on the boxer and the steam is just rising, the sweat and those blood squibs and squirts that are just they're just amplified with the monochrome visuals.
Yeah.
This film had to be in black and white, and what a fucking great choice by Marty and everyone involved to go that direction, because, you know, you get to 1980 in doing a little bit of research. That's your domain, mate. Like I said, I'm the dude sitting on the couch checking it out. There was some pushback to that initially because you're getting into the 80s where it's the beginning of the excess decade. Everyone wants something big, flashy, neon. To have this grim story about an ugly, violent man shot in stark black and white wasn't always the most obvious of choice or the most exciting of choices, but I can't imagine this film in color.
Yeah. I've got a little bit on that, which is really interesting. So with the black and white, so that originally they were going to shoot it in color, as you well know. And when this was happening, Michael Powell, who's a British director, who's actually also married to Thelma Shoemaker.
The Michael Powell.
Yeah.
Absolute legend. So, like, I don't know if you've – I know that you probably have started to invest in a few of these films yourself, Holsch, but The Black Narcissus and The Red Shoes, two of the most beautiful films of all time, that gets – so much acclaim as just foundational cinema. And then this dude went complete sicko mode. In 1960, Powell went and directed a film called Peeping Tom, which destroyed people's brains. It was so controversial at the time. And I think it got the jump on Psycho by a few months because Hitchcock's Psycho and Peeping Tom came out in the same year. Even though Psycho is an absolute classic, and I agree with that, you'd be an idiot to think it's anything less than a classic. I actually prefer Peeping Tom.
Wow.
I never realized that Thelma and Powell were married.
Yeah, well, he is the reason behind why it's black and white because, yeah, they were looking at early footage of them fighting, and he said about how the red gloves just stood out too much, and he suggested shooting it in black and white. So it sort of started to head in that direction. But then sort of a couple of other things that really confirmed it for them was they thought that the black and white imagery made the boxing feel more brutal. Also, all the boxing matches back then, when LaMotta was fighting, shown on the television set, etc., were all black and white. So it made it feel like, you know, I sent you through on YouTube a couple of days ago the actual fight against Sugar Ray Robinson, and that black and white imagery there sort of transfers straight into the movie, which I think is incredible. So much to the fact that that actual commentary of the fight is the commentary that Scorsese uses in the film. The identical, yeah. It's like, because he said that no one could portray those 1940 boxing commentators like they could back then, so he just used the real deal. The way that he executes these boxing matches, for someone that doesn't like boxing, he's turned it into a war zone of degree. I'm sure you've probably heard of this, but he changed the size of the ring for every single fight. And when you mentioned there about how the steam was coming off, etc., he had an actual fire underneath the camera. So as he was shooting,
I never realized this.
He had a little barbecue going so that he could get that heat, you know, effervescent sort of steam coming off. So as they were fighting, and that was only in one particular boxing match, because it changes every single boxing match. It's very nuanced because it's dependent on how Jake LaMotta's mental state is, and as his mental state gets worse and worse, the ring gets bigger and bigger. And
I love that aspect. And that is something that I only noticed probably, I think I've seen Raging Bull 4 times. And the first 2 times I didn't notice that. It wasn't until I rewatched it probably 3 or 4 years ago that I noticed that the ring just becomes this huge, almost void towards the end of the film.
Yeah, that when the final fight against Sugar Ray, when he's getting pummeled, absolutely pummeled, and they do that wide zoom out, you just see Sugar Ray looking at him while he's essentially beckoning him to just lay into him, and the ring just looks enormous. Last thing I'll say is Sugar Ray, the last time I watched it, I felt like he is the Terminator 2 character. He doesn't talk and he never backs down. Even when he gets hit down, like a Terminator 2, he just gets back up. And the one time that LaMotta beats him and he's in the corner and all he's doing is talking to his ringside crew and just looking over and despising LaMotta. It's almost like, yeah, I'm just going to keep coming, keep coming, keep coming until I break you down. That last boxing scene when he does get smashed by Sugar Ray was actually based off the screenplay of Psycho. They wanted to create it as a horror scene as such. And, you know, in the end, the blood splattering across the judges and then onto the ropes and down his legs.
Oh, it's horrific.
Yeah, so it was always planned to be shot like a horror film.
The other thing that really stands out for me, I love the recreation of the 1940s Bronx and New York scenery. It's just beautiful, like the architecture, the furniture, the fashion, everything is so well realized, and it's just an incredible snapshot of those times. The entire film, and you mentioned it before too, Holsh, is just technical filmmaking at its absolute peak. It would be an oversight to ignore or not discuss Kathy Moriarty's performance as Vicky, Jake's second wife. That was just such a strong performance. I love how throughout the film she's just unwilling to take Jake's shit, despite the very real threat of violence at any time, especially that scene when it's about halfway through the film, when Jake has just made up this alleged infidelity that she's gone around and fucked everyone that he knows, even fucked his brother and Frank Vincent or Selvi. He's just got this paranoia about her just cheating on him at all times. And she can see that he's about to snap. So she goes and locks herself in the bathroom. Jake like basically kicks the door in, and when he confronts her, he slaps her and hits her. And it's a tough scene to watch because it's quite violent. But how she delivers the line,
"I fucked all of them. What do you want me to say?"
"What do you mean you fucked? Who'd you fuck?"
"I fucked all of them. Tommy, well, Salvi, your brother, all of them. I sucked your brother's cock. What do you want me to say?"
"You sucked his cock."
"Yeah, I sucked his cock and everybody else on the fucking street too. What do you want? You're nothing but a fat pig, selfish fool."
"What the fuck
did you do?" "His fucking cock's bigger than yours too!"
just trying to really just put all of this back onto him, as if to say, you're being absolutely ridiculous.
I think the statement that she says, and everybody else on the fucking street too, like,
yeah,
that was the obvious.
And that's the hint where you're being ridiculous.
But he takes it literally.
Yeah. So he can't see the exaggeration in that statement. He is that clouded by paranoia and jealousy and self-loathing that not only does she falsely admit to sleeping around with his brother and with his friends or colleagues, but with the entire fucking street, and he still just goes crazy.
He does that with Joey as well in my favourite scene where he's, you know, just keeps saying, I heard some things.
Had nothing to do with me?
No.
Who did that have something to do with? Vicky?
Hey, Jack, I just explained the whole thing to you, didn't I?
Yeah.
It was between me and Salvi. If it had anything to do with you and Vicky, I would have told you about it.
That's not what I heard, Joe.
What do you mean that's not what you heard?
It's not what I heard.
What'd you hear?
I heard some things.
You heard about me and Salvi then?
I heard things, Joey.
Yeah, you heard that I cracked Salvi all around. What'd you hear?
I heard things.
What things you heard?
I heard some things.
Hey, you heard things. You want to worry? Don't start that worrying shit. You know what you should worry about? Worry you got this title fight next month. That's what you should worry about. Do that.
That's such a menacing scene too. He's like trying to get his TV reception to work. And he's just looking over his shoulder. He's like, so Joey, I've been hearing some things. And again, Joey's like, fucking what? Like, what have you heard? It's all in your head, man. Like, no, I've been hearing shit. I've been hearing some stuff.
And you're sitting on the lounge and you're just going, just fucking tell him, Joey. Just tell him, because he obviously knows.
Exactly right. That's it. Oh, man. And look, another great scene I just want to pinpoint, and again, I'm not trying to be a podcast that goes scene by scene by scene, but look, we have to point out some really pivotal stuff. And a scene that I really enjoyed, especially as a Martin Scorsese completist, is the scene where Joe Pesci, is at the club and he attacks Salvi Betts, because Salvi's like openly like conversing and slightly flirting with Jake's wife, Vicky. And that quick trigger temper, which is obviously running through the LaMotta DNA, comes out and he just starts to beat the shit out of Salvi. But what I love about it, it's a preview from the infamous scene in Goodfellas that we would see in 10 years' time, featuring the exact two same fucking actors, where it's like between Joe Pesci and Frank Vincent. I love it, especially now in hindsight. That, you know, you sit there and think, oh man, this is so cool, because Scorsese's used the same guys, different stories, obviously, different characters, different people, and has basically transferred what happened here in 1980 in Raging Bull to 1990 with Goodfellas.
I get more scared watching Joe Pesci than I do De Niro.
Yeah. That's the power of Pesci, though, man. That's the power of Pesci. Angry, angry little man. What he lacks in height, he makes up in pure aggression. In this film, though, besides that scene, he reins it in, because he both obviously admires his brother and his, I wouldn't say skill, but his courage and toughness in the ring. So he admires that, but he also fears his brother. He knows what he has in his brother, and he knows what's within his brother as far as anger and aggression. So there's always that, there's that simmering anger in Joey in this as well, but it never really gets unleashed. Besides that scene when he attacks Salvi Betts at that club. And that's almost played out in a way that he wants his brother to see that he's got his back as well. Earlier in the film, when he's sparring with Jake and Selvie's there and Jake's just beating the shit out of him, they're all kind of laughing at Joey's getting absolutely bashed. It's almost a way for Joey to show that he has that violent side, that he can stand up for himself and be a, lack of a better word, a stronger man as well.
He actually gets a rib broken in that scene when he's you hear him hitting him around the ribs, and then he's like, oh. De Niro actually broke his rib, and they kept that in the movie. Pretty cool.
Incredible. That's the other thing too. De Niro's body transformation through this is astonishing. Like, he is fucking ripped. And this is where that whole myth of De Niro being the ultimate method actor comes from, right? So there's all this talk, and you've probably, again, done way more research than me, and I'm retelling stories and stuff I've read 20-something years ago. But De Niro got to the point he was so fit and so well-trained as a boxer that people were saying he could have fought semi-professionally himself. And on the flip side of that, towards the end of the film, where they're displaying Jake LaMotta just letting himself go post-retirement, just becoming a failed fucking comedian, the body transformation of De Niro from being this incredible athlete to an absolute slob. And look, I'm not body shaming, man, because I am running the post-retirement Jake LaMotta body myself.
27 kilos he put on, which is just incredible. Went over to Italy and just ate pasta for 3 or 4 months. Apparently, like, it was good fun for the first 13 kilos he put on, but then he was very, very, a lot of side effects, a lot of illnesses after to try and get that last 14 kilos. So much so that Scorsese wanted to pause the film because he was so worried about De Niro's health. That just shows his dedication. 12 months in the lead up to start shooting this, he trained with Jake LaMotta in the ring. So LaMotta trained him how to box in his particular style. And this was this period where he became very, very ripped. And before they shot, he had 3 professional bouts and he won 2 of the 3. I don't know what level of professional boxing it was, but yeah, he won 2 on points. The attention to detail for him, both in lead up, during, and even the way that they shot a lot of the scenes, like, he would tell people, look, I need you to hit me, I need you to attack me as if it's real, as if your life depended on it, because otherwise it's not going to look real on the film. And this is just De Niro's way.
And the integrity of that comes through in the film. You can tell that this guy isn't just some actor that's just throwing haymakers. The craft has been perfected. I didn't realize, I do vaguely recall remembering that he was either told he could perform at a semi-professional level as a boxer or did actually fight. So that, I'm glad you said that, because I did remember that, but I had forgotten or never really realized that LaMotta himself helped train De Niro.
LaMotta was basically on the set for all the boxing scenes, but they would not let him be in the studio when they were doing the drama scenes, because obviously...
Oh, understandably so, yeah. Too, because one thing I do remember from years ago was that LaMotta was very excited about the prospect of his life being put up on the screen. He wasn't as excited as he thought he would be after seeing it for the first time. Famously was not impressed with how he was depicted. He was probably looking for that classic generic style biopic where they just take the person and just show all the highlight reel, the good bits, without very little of the downfall or the ugly parts.
All sports movies around that period and leading up to it were, you know, the sports star that overcame all odds.
This is post-Rocky too, isn't it? So he's probably thinking, this is my Rocky.
Yeah, it's exactly what he would have been thinking. And one thing we didn't mention at the beginning, the book that Jake LaMotta wrote never, ever talked about Joey. Schrader was the one.
Oh, wow, really?
No, he's not in the book at all. So the book is actually about him, and it's written by him and one of his best friends. And it's about himself, but his best friend is the person that sort of threw the book the most. And what's happened is Schrader's discovered that he had a younger brother. By the way, Pesci is 37 when he's shooting this film, and he's acting as a 16 or 18 year old Joey.
That's so good. That's like reminding me of like Jason Priestley and Luke Perry playing high school students in Beverly Hills 90210 in the 90s. You had fucking Luke Perry, who was like 40 something with all these wrinkles and shit. But yeah, he's a 17 year old.
Yeah, but Schrader realized that he had this brother, and he thought the movie would be a lot more gripping if that character wasn't a best friend, but more so his brother. So his mate is actually the one that he thought, with his paranoia, had slept with Vicky and basically pulverized him almost to death. But in the movie, they change it to the brother. So,
wow, yeah. Okay. I never realized that.
Yeah, so much so that Joey LaMotta actually sued the producers because the story was so incorrect. And with the character Vicky, also to give her some insight. So when she married LaMotta, she was 16 and LaMotta was 24. She was raped at 14. So she had some dealings with not so desirable human beings already. And I know we sort of, we took a bit of a detour away from Kathy Moriarty's acting, but man, she's just so natural, so real. And she was 19 when they grabbed her, and this is her first ever film. I just thought,
yeah,
unbelievable.
And her, I went through and had a look at what else she's done. There's not a lot of other notable roles for her, in a sense that there was nothing else that ever hit the heights anywhere near Raging Bull. She appeared again alongside De Niro in a movie that I really like that's underrated called Copland, starring Sylvester Stallone and one of my other goats, baby, Harvey Keitel. But she is incredible in this film. And in fact, upon rewatch, she's one of my favorite parts of the entire film. Her role, her performance in this is incredible. And the other thing too, probably, and I'm just guessing here, and I don't like to, you know, guess people's intentions, but perhaps the reason why she decided to marry LaMotta at such a young age too is the fact that she'd already been assaulted as a younger female, probably thinking that even though she was still only 16, I've got a potential world champion boxer that's in love with me. This might offer me some form of protection as well.
Yeah, true. That's very true. Good point.
So, you know, that's, you know, again, I'm just guessing, but that could have played a part in that. Speaking of 14-year-olds, towards the end of the film, obviously, we see the downfall in post-retirement, what we spoke about before with the weight gain for De Niro, but it's also the highlights just how low Jake LaMotta got to the point where he's drunk in a club after doing some, I'll say it nicely, mediocre comedy routine. We have Jake drunkenly in the bar, in the club, and he's introducing a young girl who he does ask if she's 21, introduces her to a group of men, and then we later find out that she is 14 and he is arrested for introducing her to these men and goes to jail, does a stint while he's in Florida, while he's in Miami. I imagine that wouldn't have been a favourite part of LaMotta's viewing of this movie when he saw that either. It does not paint him in a very nice light as well.
And after that, he needed to get bail and pay for bail, and that's got that scene in there where he's ripping out the jewels out of his world belt, and then discovers when he takes it to the pawn shop, whatever it is, that, you know, it would have been worth a shitload more to take the whole belt in, which, I mean, to any sane person is, the whole time when I watched it that first viewing, I was like, oh no, that's just him didn't want to give the belt. Jake, no matter what, he wants to keep that belt. But then on the commentary that Jake LaMotta says, he's like, oh, I was so stupid. Why didn't I take the whole belt?
He's not a very smart man. And this film does a really good job in highlighting that. But yeah, that again, that's an incredible scene. Like, he just begs Vicky to let him in the house. He's like, yeah, they'll let me out on bail. I need to get some money together and all this kind of stuff. And then just starts going fucking crazy on his belt with his hammer, trying to get the jewels out of it. He's not a very smart man. We've spoken about it and everyone else has spoken about it. A lot smarter people than I have spoken about De Niro's performance in this. And look, it deserves every single accolade he's ever received. He deserves it. For a dude that has this resume that he has, for me, it still stands out as his most well-rounded work. And look, by that I mean, okay, Heat, the 1995 Michael Mann film, spoiler alert, is my all-time favorite film. Right, so that's giving away what's going to win 1995. And look, the way we go on Hulsh, we won't get to 95 until probably to 2034. So hopefully listeners will forget by then. But Heat is my favorite film of all time. It contains an incredible performance by De Niro, but he shows so much more range, and range is a word I typically don't like to use sometimes to describe performances, but the range he shows in Raging Bull dwarfs even Heat. Like, the confidence he displays at the very same time as the vulnerability that he displays in this performance is just second to none. And sometimes performances and films have all these accolades and you watch them and you go, oh, does it really live up to that? This performance lives up to that hype.
Well and truly. Look, I think this particular performance from all the movies I've seen, which is nowhere near like saying tip of the iceberg for what you've seen, but it's the best performance I've seen from an actor as far as realism towards character behavior, as in 24/7. Even when he's not in a speaking scene, he's in the background. Every little quirk that he has from Jake, he's using that to his advantage the whole time. Apparently, like, he was 24/7 Jake as well on the set, to the point him and Joe Pesci were living together during the shooting so that they could have that brother connection. Him and Joe Pesci, this is on the commentary from the Joe Pesci's wife in the film. She said that wherever they went, that's who they were. They were Jake LaMotta and Joey LaMotta. So you just got used to, like, that was the only character you knew of them. You didn't know the real Robert De Niro. And the way that he treats Jake LaMotta in this film is so fucking real. I'll go as far as to say it's got a real intimacy to this film, because you're in so close to this guy's life in some of these scenes that you're just like, it feels like you've just been dropped in that room with him. And I think that is a big part because of his performance. And it's just like, I'm actually getting goosebumps here. And that's the first time that, just thinking about the film, that it really hit me how unbelievable De Niro's performance was.
You just nailed that. The realism in it. Nothing feels actorly, overacted, false, fake, whatever you want to call it. It just, like you said, all, it's just so nuanced, and every, like, facial, every tick, every vocal tick, every type of look that De Niro gives in this film just feels so legitimate. It is an incredible performance. And look, to sum up, it's a film that's hard to talk about in respect that, like I said before, it has been spoken about 1,000 times by a lot of people that are a lot smarter than you and I, that are absolute film historians. And I've always felt this kind of shame that I've not felt more or thought of this film more highly. And I say that with all respect, because, I mean, this is still in the best films of this particular year for me. And whether at the end of this project of the 1980 year that we're doing at the moment, if it goes up or down, I think it's always going to be around that 5 or 6 mark in this year. This is such a stacked year. And it feels like I'm disrespecting the film, but I'm really not. It's on so many best ever lists and all that, and I totally understand why. It's a classic for this year. I've never fallen completely in love with it. I've felt at arm's length from it sometimes, and I don't know if that's a criticism, but it's just such a technical and incredible marvel of filmmaking and performance by everyone involved. Maybe it's my allergy to biopics. I don't know. Maybe that's slightly clouding my vision. I've never been a fan of biopics, but this, again, isn't your typical biopic. It's, in fact, probably the most honest of all biopics, give or take that inclusion of the brother character instead of the friend character, which I wasn't completely aware of until you mentioned that tonight, actually. That's how little I've actually looked into it. I've always just taken that as gospel. I don't know. There's always this something that has kept me from putting this as number one for 1980 in my top 10 of all time. And I've always felt a bit of a shame about that. But I've got no shame in saying that this is easily one of the best films of 1980. After all these rewatches, it's a film I've always admired and respected, and I do genuinely love. And I still feel, though, that ranking it at number 6 in 1980 is doing it a disservice.
Mate, I completely disagree. I think that's fine. Like, I've watched 22 films from 1980 since you started this project for me, and it's not in my top 10. But it's probably the best movie. You know what I mean? It's probably the best movie out of the 22, but it's not in my favorite top 10. And that's, so be it. That's who we are. Certain movies are going to draw you in certain ways, and everyone's very different. And I know lots of people out there that love, you know, this type of movie that is very intimate and just character, you know, it's basically built around a character, and they
it's
just
character driven, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. But you know, that doesn't mean that it works for everybody. And like I said, I think it is the best movie of 1980 that I've watched out of those 22, but it's definitely not in my top 10. Like there's a foreign film, slapstick comedy, action violence film that we haven't touched on. I'll touch on it in our 1980 breakdown that I've got ahead of Raging Bull. And it's like,
nice.
You know, no one in their right world in the critic scene would ever consider that. But as far as how much it makes me want to watch it and get down in my cinema and put it on, that film, I'd watch it 5 times before I'd watch Raging Bull again.
That's awesome. I've got a sneaking suspicion I know that film, and I have never seen it, which I'm very jealous about. I'm going to have to rectify that. Well, that's good. I'm glad I'm not alone in that assumption that this is a film that I admire and respect more than honestly, truly love. But that'll do it. I think that'll do it for tonight. You've got anything else to add at all, Holsch, about Raging Bull?
We didn't really talk about the sound too much, and I think the sound in this movie is absolutely phenomenal. The music, the way they hit that Scorsese uses the sound through, and some of the fight scenes in particular where as they hit each other, that some of the really impactful moments of the punches.
It's punishing.
There's a couple of punches in it where they'll have like an elephant and 5 or 6 different animals all go off at the same time as they hit. When you know that that's there and you hear it on a rewatch, you're like, wow, that was astonishing. So I just think the sound on this film is just another 10 out of 10. One last, and it's just a really tiny one. I just want to give a little bit of kudos to his first wife. I think her acting performance in this is fucking remarkable. Even though she's only in it for a little while, she's nailed it, and it really sets up his character right from the beginning. When he grabs her on the back of the neck, and you can see that this guy can turn in an instant. He's got that switch. I just thought the way that when he's about to go out to the ball and she's going off a ticker, I don't know how many times I use the word faggot in this film, but at this era, it's just, you know, it's rampant. And yeah, they used the word fuck 114 times in it, and apparently Scorsese got better and better at that, because in Casino that jumps up to 422 times. But
there's a lot of fucks in Casino. And am I right in saying that one of the reasons Jake LaMotta disliked the film was he said there was too much swearing in it, that he never swore this much himself? Is that right?
I'm not sure. To be honest, I flicked to certain scenes for his commentary because it was pretty unbearable to listen to.
So yeah, he's not a very bright spark.
Yeah, and the last thing I wanted to just touch on was the final scene when he's in the jail cell. I just think that scene is unbelievable, where he's smashing his head against the wall, and it's that moment in the film when you sort of reflect on everything else that he's done wrong, everyone he's treated terrible, even his brother. You know, obviously that scene that he hurts Joey is sickening, but I look back at the whole film, and the whole film, Jake LaMotta is about Jake LaMotta, and yeah. At that point in time, you know, he's screaming that he's so stupid. And you wonder at that point in time, did he learn anything? And then it goes to Fat Jake doing his comedy routine. And, you know, that Fat Jake is at the bookends of the start and end of the movie. And he finishes with that, I'm the boss, I'm the boss, I'm the boss. While he's doing the fist pumps. And it's like, this guy has not changed an iota.
No, not at all. He has not learned a single fucking lesson. And a cool little tidbit about that is, and it's actually one of the top reviews on Letterboxd about Raging Bull is, someone wrote that at the end of the film when Jake hops up in front of the mirror and says, I'm the boss, and is fixing his like shirt and pants and stuff like that. The top review, or one of the top reviews on Letterboxd, says, I was waiting for him to pull out his cock. And that's in reference to, have you seen Boogie Nights?
Yeah. That last
so obviously, Paul Thomas Anderson's taken that scene at the end of Raging Bull and has completely done the homage to that scene with Dirk Diggler hanging the big cock out at the end.
Yeah,
only just kind of dawned on me my last watch. I actually thought that when I watched it, and I was like, oh, that's, you know, I can see where Boogie Nights gets its conclusion from now. And then went on to Letterboxd to do the very smallest bit of research that, you know, I do. And I had a good chuckle. Who was the review by? Let me have a look. It's by a guy called Brian Espitia. And it states, I thought LaMotta was going to unzip his pants at the end and pull out a giant fake cock. End quote.
I've heard a lot of those top letterboxed comments or something that are pretty abrupt and easy for people to jump on board with.
Absolutely. So that's number six for 1980. We are now into the business end of the year, Holsch. We are going top five territory next week. I'm getting pretty excited.
I've got the preview of what that five is, and to all the listeners out there, there is some that are just going to blow you away and not what you expect. You know what I mean?
Yeah, number five especially is one it's one for the freaks. There's some weird, deep shit going on in that one. So this is number six, Raging Bull, directed by Martin Scorsese. We will return in a week's time. Hopefully, there's no illnesses. I really hope I don't get hit with my third stomach bug in the course of a month. If not, we will be back with number five. And thanks for listening, folks. Please, if you are listening, like and subscribe to our podcast on either Apple Music or Spotify. And check us out on Instagram. Chuck us a like. I've been a bit shy. I haven't created a Twitter account as of yet. I want a portfolio. I want some episodes up our sleeve before I start tooting our horn on Twitter. But I am on Twitter personally. My handle is Chip Pierce, all one word. So check a brother out. And yes, that's been Lifetime Cinema Club for this week. And we'll talk to y'all next week.